You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, August 15th. 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. My vacation continues. All of my anxieties have melted away, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear the change in my voice, the sing-song equality? Of course, what you're not hearing is that angst that I've been spending too much time with my children and my family. But that's because I'm actually recording it before we went on vacation. So I have traveled through time. And at first I had gone into the future, and now I've gone back. And I'm actually in the present, even though I'm now talking to you in the future. And when you hear this, I will have been talking in the past. Now that I've blown your mind, how about an interview from RJ Eskow? One from Shenna Bellows, running for Senate in Maine. And one from Melissa Schwartz of the Alliance for Justice. Interviews that I did at Netroots Nation 2014. In Detroit last month, and then from members, get ready for it, another deep, deep archive. George Carlin. Janine Garofalo and I interviewed George Carlin back in 2004 on the original Majority Report. So enjoy today's interviews. On Monday, more new content for you. John Nichols. Members will also get some more bonuses. Saddam Hussein. It's not really Saddam Hussein. It's Fred Armisen as Saddam Hussein. And I'm pretty sure. And Rick Perlstein from way back when. But for now, enjoy RJ Eskow, Shenna Bellows, Melissa Schwartz from the Alliance for Justice, and members, enjoy the George Carlin interview. We're back live Wednesday. Continuing our coverage from Netroots Nation 2014 in Detroit, Michigan. Joining me now, it is always a pleasure to talk to RJ Eskow. He is a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future and the host of the Zero Hour. RJ, welcome to the program.
Always good to be with you, Sam.
RJ, why Zero Hour?
Well, you know, because I think there are so many things happening economically, environmentally, politically, that represent a point of no return. I mean, not to be overly dramatic about it, but there's a point at which, for example, the increasing influence of money in politics is going to create irreversibility, both in terms of electoral politics and, more importantly, in terms of the court system. So we've got that. Environmentally, the scientists tell us we're reaching already past certain turning points beyond which there's no turning back in terms of global warming, climate destabilization. There are likely to be more so in it. And they all converge, basically. It's all about corporate and economic influence over different areas of our lives, big data surveillance. So I guess I would say in so many of those issues, we have to act quickly. And the real story is that I was kind of crowdsourcing the name of the show, and we couldn't come up with a good name. And finally, I said, come on, guys, we need a name. We got to start printing the materials. This is a zero hour. What is it? And then I read the email back to myself and thought, this is a zero. I love it. So the show's website is thisisthezerohour.com, and the name of the show is The Zero Hour.
That's great, actually. And that is a question I've been asking myself, I think, for 10 years. And it's one I don't like to think about too much, because you'd hate to say, like, well, actually, no, we're 30 minutes past the zero hour, or you don't want to come to that conclusion. But now that I've gotten that question answered, let's talk about something that, and I know you and I have talked about Social Security in about half a different ways. You have a great piece up that people can find over the past month about the secret attempt to harm Social Security by closing down its offices. And you know, of course, you hurt customer service. You begin to weaken the strength of the program, which is that people love it. But another thing that I want to talk about, because this has been floating around and it has the smell of one of those issues that we're going to hear from the right wing. It sort of came up a couple of years ago. PBS ran a story, or 60 Minutes, I think, ran a story
right. That
was full of fallacies. But and that is Social Security disability.
Right.
Now, before we go into the attacks, just tell people, because I don't know that everybody realizes that it's SSDI,
right.
That it's Social Security. This is a part of Social Security. Tell us about that.
Well, people get Social Security disability coverage in two ways. One is if they've never worked and they've always been disabled, there's a form of insurance that covers them. But the bulk of Social Security disability insurance comes from the money you pay directly in, just the same way that your retirement benefits do. Comes from that money. If you get hurt on the job, it's a form of government-sponsored disability insurance that says you'll get a certain, not generous, but you'll get a certain amount of money if you get injured on the job. And it's tied to how much you've put in and that, your wage base and all that. So this is, like Social Security retirement benefits, something we pay for, a form of insurance.
And and the premiums come in the form of payroll taxes, and our premiums are matched by our employer. And all right, so Social Security disability, the story that we've been hearing now since the crash in 2008 is that Social Security disability insurance is rampant with fraud, that the claims have gone through the roof, and that it is a fraud-ridden program and something's wrong. That's story A that we hear from the right. There's also a story B, which is that the trust fund for the disability insurance is going to run out in 2 years, I think it is now, which is much sooner, obviously, than the retirement insurance capacity. Let's take the second one first.
Right.
Where are we at with disability insurance in terms of the trust fund?
Well, first of all, yes, the trust fund, which is much smaller than the retirement trust fund, has, quote unquote, run out of money. It's a melodramatic way to say, you know, has a cash flow issue. Congress has already dealt with this 11 times, and it's very simple.
Just 11 times?
Just 11 times. And what they do is when that fund needs a temporary cash infusion, emphasis on the word temporary, then they take money out of the other fund, which now has more than $2 trillion in it. They keep it going, and then they rebalance it. Everything gets squared away. Congress, Republican Congresses have done it. Democratic Congresses have done it. It's never been an issue. This time, all of a sudden, we hear that Senator Orrin Hatch and people in the House are going to make a big issue of this is a crisis and this is an emergency and we're not going to bail them out. We have to confront a fundamental problem, which, by the way, doesn't exist. Any long-term actuarial imbalance is easily fixed in a number of ways. But as a staffer to a Republican senator said very candidly to a writer in the Wall Street Journal, Senator Hatch wants to use this to leverage a much bigger discussion. And that bigger discussion is cutting Social Security.
Yeah, this is the hook, right? I mean, right. We see this with the Highway Trust Fund is going through its own situation right now. Let's not get into it. But these funds periodically are set up in certain ways as not to keep pace with inflation. In this instance, what we're looking at is really a rather predictable demographic, or should have been predicted, demographic blip, right? I mean, isn't that when we hear that there is just so many people on disability, how is this explained? There seems to be a fairly straightforward explanation for it.
Well, one, absolutely straightforward. There are a couple. One is, compared to other developed countries, we don't have a lot of people on disability. We're comparatively difficult to get on. The process is made extremely difficult in this country. The rules are strict, but because of the cutbacks in the offices, it can take more than a year to get on. And can you imagine being disabled at work, losing a limb or something, and then being without your benefits for a year? I mean, that's inhumane. But and once you get on, our benefits are the worst of any developed country except Korea. So, but you hear these scare talks about, and the other explanation is, look, our workforce is getting older,
right.
So people are going to injure themselves a little bit more on the job. That's also a factor. But isn't it ironic that the same Republicans who want to keep raising the retirement age higher and higher and higher are also upset that older workers are becoming disabled more? The way to prevent that is to lower the retirement age.
Right. Well, let's be clear. It's not just Republicans.
Sure.
I mean, let's be clear. There's, I haven't heard... Well, we hear raising the retirement age for Medicare floated around, which is also even almost more ridiculous. We hear this from, if not Democratic politicians, although I imagine we hear from some, certainly some of those Democratic politicians appoint special commissions. Simpson-Bowles comes to mind.
Sure.
And we certainly hear it from some supposed liberal commentators why being so chaste about the retirement age, and the reality is the retirement age is going up.
Right.
It is 65 now for full benefits, but by the time I retire, it's going to be 67.
Right.
And so the
right,
this is a demographic. I mean, we have an aging workforce. More chance to be ill, I guess, and to become disabled. I would also imagine that going through a period of financial insecurity makes it that much harder as well on some level in terms of just creating. We know stress creates chronic disease, and this also has an impact.
Well, presumably, but I think that gets exaggerated, too, because I think that one of the things the right likes to do is say, well, they're all shirking, or they're afraid they're going to get laid off, so they jump onto disability. The system does not really make that very easy to do. And as to your other point, I don't give Democrats a free pass.
Right.
I'll be pretty rough on them on this stuff. On the disability issue specifically, I'll say it's been the Republicans pushing that one, and at least we've had Sherrod Brown... as
right.
Really being a great voice for it. But the leadership, Obama and so on, they really haven't said anything about the disability issue up to now that I've tracked.
And so this sounds like it may be a fall campaign type of push.
Right.
I mean, that we're going to see from the Republicans. It's a great way to sort of imply they're on the side of Social Security benefactors, of old people in general, while still sort of like... implying that the disability is really a way for non-white people getting a shake, right? I mean, they're sort of built, custom-built for that.
Yeah, you bet. Look, they're always trying to turn, and I would include some Democrats in this, one kind of American against another, right? And so they had, and it was Obama's appointee to run that deficit commission, Alan Simpson, who used the phrase greedy geezers. They tried to demonize old people, but that didn't work because everybody who votes is either old themselves or loves somebody who is.
Well, and Alan Simpson is... clearly an advocate for young people. I've seen some of his parody videos.
He's younger than springtime.
Right.
But look, So the greedy geezers thing didn't work out. So you got to find another scapegoat. And I think you're right on the money. I think the issue here is, you know, the shirkers.
Right.
The ones who don't want to work so hard. And you might say,
and what are we talking about for an average disability payment from Social Security?
You're in the range of a little over $1,000 a month. I mean, we're not talking about big dollars here.
Right. This isn't, I've taken the opportunity to go and buy a bungalow in Tulum, Mexico, and on the beach. This is basically, I'm able to eat, and I'm able maybe to pay my rent.
Right, but if I got a house, I have to sell it. If I got two cars, I have to sell one, both probably, and get an old one, or take public transportation, which gets us into the other issue of the inflation rates and the fights over CPI, as they call it, and all that. But without even going into that, we've got... So we've got an issue where we have an ungenerous disability system, second worst of all developed countries. We've got a terrible ordeal you have to go through to get on it, which could include years of poverty while you wait to get approved. And they're taking those people now and demonizing them instead of saying, you know what, we could add 0.2% to the payroll tax, or we could ask the rich to pay a little more, or we could ask Wall Street to pay. There are a million ways to fix this problem. But no, let's find a scapegoat and go after them.
Richard Eskow, senior fellow of the Campaign for America's Future and host of The Zero Hour. You can find it at thisisthezerohour.com. Thanks so much for your time today.
You bet, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop globe. Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spirals the wrong way out the sink. And her voice is a backwards record. It's like a whirlpool and it never. In the glow of each other's majestic presence. Listen in and hear my words to the ones you would think I would say if there wasn't me for you. All alone at the 64.
Joining me now, live from Netroots Nation, is Shenna Bellows. She is running for the Senate in Maine against Susan Collins, the Republican. Shenna, welcome to the program.
Hello, it's a pleasure to meet you in person.
Yes, we've spoken on interviews from afar. It's great to meet you in person as well. Shenna, just tell people, for those people who haven't heard of your candidacy in the past, just give us a sense of your background and what are some of the major issues you're running on.
I'm the progressive Democratic nominee for United States Senate from Maine, challenging Republican Susan Collins. I'm former executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Maine. I was a leader on Maine's successful marriage equality campaign and a leader on our statewide ballot campaign to promote voting rights. So my background is civil liberties and civil rights. That's why the Progressive Change Campaign Committee called me the Elizabeth Warren of civil liberties.
That's right. And so and we've spoken many times. We're going to be talking more at Netroots to the folks from the PCCC. Give us a sense of, you know, Susan Collins is ostensibly one of the last of the martyr Republicans. Give me a sense of how much you think that she's been able to actually moderate the Republicans.
Well, I think the Republicans have become so extreme, and the Supreme Court decisions in Citizens United and Hobby Lobby demonstrate that the stakes are really too high to enable a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. Republican Susan Collins has had little or no influence on folks like Ted Cruz and Mitch McConnell. And in fact, it seems they've had an influence on her.
Right.
She voted against equal pay for equal work, against raising the minimum wage. She even voted to defund Planned Parenthood when that whole controversy happened a couple of years ago. That's not moderate.
Yeah, we hear a lot about how she is, you know, ostensibly a moderate, but there's it seems time and time again when push comes to shove, really, the moderation that we're supposed to buy into is just the fact that she was a little bit deliberative in ultimately coming to agree with guys like Ted Cruz or et al. In the Senate. Give me a sense of some of the top issues, though, that you're pursuing. You say civil liberties equal rights, but give us a sense of the specifics there.
So my top three issues are jobs in the economy, civil liberties and civil rights, because that's my background, and climate change, which I think is the gravest threat facing our country and our planet. And my background, I grew up the daughter of a carpenter without electricity or running water in rural Maine. And what I think we're seeing is the disappearance of the middle class and the disappearance of pathways of opportunity for young people like I was. We are seeing that ability to rise up out of poverty slipping away. And that's why I really think this election is about the future of our country. Are we going to continue to cede ground to the wealthiest individuals and the largest corporations who brought our economy to the brink of collapse and are ruining our environment right now?
And from a civil liberties perspective, obviously there's been more revelations recently. The Snowden that came from Snowden's whistleblowing. Give me your sense of how the you feel the Senate and Congress as a whole has responded.
I think we've experienced a constitutional crisis that undermines our democracy over the last decade. I started out at the ACLU as an anti-Patriot Act organizer, and I think we need to repeal the Patriot Act. We need to place checks and balances on the NSA. And when I made the final decision to run was in Maine, we passed this amazing law to require warrants before law enforcement accesses your email or your phone records. And we did that by building a coalition around shared principle of Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Green Party members alike. We were one of two states in the country to do it. And a reporter asked me, well, isn't the real problem with the NSA? And of course it is. And we have not seen change to place meaningful checks and balances on the NSA. And we do need still to repeal the Patriot Act and restore our civil liberties, to restore public trust in our government again.
There's also another issue coming out of Maine that I have found fascinating and disturbing, and that is your governor, Paul LePage, has, and apparently he has not denied the allegations to the extent that I know, that he has been meeting with sovereign citizens on a regular basis over the course of a year, 9 months, and... Well, you tell me. You're up there. You must know this story. Tell us about what the governor has been up to.
So our governor met with a group that has been identified by the FBI as affiliated with a domestic terrorist group 8 times. And in the course of those conversations, discussed arresting, trying for treason, the Senate president and the Speaker of the House, both progressive Democrats, and potentially hanging them in Maine, a state that doesn't have the death penalty. The governor literally summons the local sheriff, because this group only recognizes the authority of the county sheriffs as legitimate in their eyes, members of law enforcement.
Summons. All right, wait, let's pause there for a moment so that people can absorb this. This is a group that the governor knows is affiliated with a group that's on the terrorist watch list, because they actually present the governor with this information. They're bragging about it. The FBI considers us to be affiliated with a terrorist group, is my understanding. Then these people believe that the only legitimate law enforcement authority in the country is the county sheriffs. I mean, I have literally done comedy routines based on this. And the governor believes this so much so that he summons the local county sheriff to check with the county sheriff, if that's the case.
To meet with the sheriff and inquire whether it would be possible for him to arrest the Senate president and the Speaker of the House for treason.
What did the sheriff say when the governor... Like, he must get a call and say, like, oh, the governor office wants to see me. I wonder what this is about. And he comes into the office and the governor says, hey, do you have the authority to arrest them because they're my political opponents? And the sheriff says what?
To be honest, I haven't spoken with the sheriff, but I can't imagine what was going through his mind. What I understand is he gave a very reasonable, politely declined to, in fact, go and arrest the Senate president, the Speaker of the House. And then the governor's legal staff had to prepare a memo for him explaining the law and why this would not be possible. So lest your listeners think, well, then Shana Bellows, a progressive Democrat, has no chance of winning the U.S. Senate race in a state as nuts as this. Let me tell you, 61% of Mainers did not vote for Governor Paul LePage. We have a bumper sticker in Maine that's prevalent and just says 61%. He won in a fluke, in a three-way race between a liberal independent and a strong Democrat. They split the vote. He won. That's why we have an extremist Republican governor. He also won because people like Republican Susan Collins, my opponent, endorsed him, supported his campaign, fundraised for him. And a month ago, she stood on a stage with him at a unity rally proclaiming her support for him and his agenda. That's not moderate either.
Well, here's the part. And you know what? Let's take a break, because when we come back, I want to talk to you about what Susan Collins' reaction has been to these revelations that the governor of her state has been meeting with members of a group that is associated with a terrorist group who espouse such literally comedic ideas and would be funny if they weren't so dangerous. I want to talk about what Susan Collins' response to me is on that, because obviously she has had to have addressed that, and you can tell us about that when we get back from the break. And then I also want to talk about what you've got planned to try. You know, you're facing an uphill battle in terms of money against the sitting incumbent Republican senator. What your plans are to get the media attention, to get the attention of Maine voters. We got to take a break. We are live from Netroots Nation, and I'm talking to Shana Bellows. She's a candidate for Maine's Senate seat in this 2014 election. We'll be right back after this. So, Shana, before the break, I was asking you, we heard the story of Maine Governor Paul LePage. It is a bizarre story. It has not been denied by the governor. They've basically acknowledged that the facts are true. He had been meeting regularly with sovereign citizens who claimed that the county sheriff was the only position of authority in the country. Each county sheriff. The governor called the county sheriff to his office to see if he could arrest his political opponents for treason. The governor's own lawyers had to basically stage an intervention with the governor by presenting him a legal brief explaining that no, it's not the case that the sheriff is the only authority and has the power to arrest your political opponents, or that you could hang them or in the town square. And the question is that I pose to you, you're running against Susan Collins. She's a senator of the United States. She has been on stage with this governor, granted, before these revelations have come out, saying that I support this man. Since these revelations have come out, without any denial from the governor's office and an acknowledgement of some of the facts, at least, what is her reaction? I imagine it's been to distance herself.
It's been absolute silence. And no one has pressed her to condemn his actions or to rebuke him for engaging in this extremist speech and this extremist agenda. She has been absolutely 100% silent.
This is shocking to me, the idea that a senator would have no response to the governor meeting with people who are associated with people who are on the FBI terrorist watch list. This is bizarre. I don't understand. Is the media not holding her to account? I don't understand this.
No, the media is not holding her to account on this and on other actions where she aids and abets the most extreme elements of her party. And silence, at the end of the day, when it matters, is complicity. Silence is complicity. And so she needs to be held accountable for supporting Paul LePage, for helping him become our governor, even if it was just with 39% of the vote. She needs to stand up and say, why is she supporting another Tea Party extremist who's running in our second congressional district, Bruce Poliquin? She just wrote him a $5,000 check for a Tea Party guy who has a radical agenda to harm women's rights, harm the economy, harm the environment. So it's not moderate to support the most radical Republicans in your own party and promote them to positions of power. It's dangerous.
Yeah, I'm just stunned. I would imagine Maine voters would demand, like, hey, you've got to weigh in on this. I mean, you're the senator. Maybe she believes that only the sheriff should really weigh in on something like this. But all right, Shanna, so you are going on a walking tour of Maine. Tell us about that. How long is this going to last?
We're walking from the northern border of Maine, the Canadian border in Houlton, Maine, to the New Hampshire border in southern Maine in the town of Kittery, over 350 miles through 63 communities. And through the months of July and August, we're incredibly excited about this grassroots effort, because ultimately campaigns should be conversations in backyards and living rooms, exchanges about the ideas and the issues of our day. Too frequently, it's who has the most money wins. This is right. A test case to see if grassroots organizing at the local level can triumph over big money in politics. We're betting that it can, and that we will bring the Barack Obama voters who brought Barack Obama to victory in 2012 in Maine, bring Shanna Bellows to victory for the U.S. Senate in 2014.
And so, I mean, how does it work? I mean, what are you hoping happens when you, as you're walking into a town? It's basically a way of making people, you know, it's obviously something that people aren't used to seeing, somebody walking the length of the state. And it's a way of basically getting the media to pay attention to talk about these issues that are important to Maine voters.
A lot of Americans feel left out by politics that elevates the interests of big corporations and big money over the interests of ordinary people. People feel left out and left behind by the politics in Washington. This is an opportunity to give voice to those folks on the ground, to talk about issues that are affecting our local communities, about jobs and the economy, and to lift up their voices and make their voices heard.
And I hope the words Governor Paul LePage supporter Susan Collins are uttered many times on the course of it. So, I mean, give me a sense of just how big of a battle this is. And I know that you've gotten help from the PCCC. These guys have been really great in finding progressive candidates and helping them where they won't necessarily get as much help from the Democratic establishment. I mean, tell me, what are some of the biggest challenges? I imagine fundraising is one of those.
Fundraising is one challenge, but the PCCC and other groups like Democracy for America have helped us raise over $1 million through grassroots contributions. Our average contribution is $60. Our median contribution is $6. Half of our contributions are $6 or less. This is really a people's campaign. And so this is a Democratic state. Our target voter is a Barack Obama voter. For a challenger, someone, my career was in civil rights and civil liberties. My biggest challenge is name recognition. And with this grassroots support, we can have a real discussion of the issues that really matter to people: raising the minimum wage, equal pay for equal work, protecting the environment, restoring civil liberties. And if we're successful in getting that message through, we will win this race.
Susan Collins is exhibiting a little bit of concern about your candidacy. People are talking about the Shanna effect. What is that?
It's true. A columnist for the Bangor Daily News first wrote about it in observing that her votes are changing this year. That 2 years ago, she voted to allow Hobby Lobby and any other corporation to deny women access to birth control or any healthcare service based on religious objections. And then we just saw that she voted against Hobby Lobby, and that was the right thing to do, but it was essentially the Shanna effect, that in an election year, she's willing to do the right thing. But when she perceives that there isn't that public pressure, she's voting with Mitch McConnell and the extremists in her party. There have been a few other votes like that.
And we should say that Senate vote was pretty clear that it was not going to pass the Senate. You know, this would be or to the extent that it would, we know it's going to die in the House. And so this is, you know, she felt that she could get a pass on that.
It's not true courage to vote when you don't think it's going to pass.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? When Mitch McConnell says, hey, we need your vote, she's going to be there for him. And that's one of the biggest problems that we have in terms of, you know, particularly with the chance that the Democrats may lose the Senate. And then gosh knows, I mean, the gloves will be off. But Shanna Bellows, if people want to get more information, where could they go to get that information?
fellowsforsenate.com. And like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, follow us on our walk across Maine.
All right. Shannon Bellis, thank you so much. All right, continuing with our coverage, Netroots Nation 2014. We are in Detroit, and with me now is Michelle Schwartz. She is the Director of the Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
So, Justice Programs, you deal with, I guess, justice in the sense of judges, and maybe it's a double entendre.
Yes, it is a little bit, but yes, primarily dealing with the federal courts and making sure that the federal courts are open and accessible to all Americans, regardless of their wealth or power, and that the federal courts aren't just there for the privileged few.
And in fact, the Supreme Court, over the past couple of years, there was one case in California and there was another case very recently that dealt with issues of access to courts in terms of arbitration clauses in contracts. Now, I don't think that people necessarily always make that connection, but talk about those cases and what the Supreme Court has done to basically shut average people out of the courts.
Well, I think everybody is familiar with, you know, every day you're going online, you are signing up and saying, okay, I want to use Instagram, or I want to apply for this credit card, or I want to get a new cell phone. And everybody is subject to these kind of click-through agreements. And, you know, and very few people read them. The Chief Justice of the United States has said he doesn't even read all the words in those contracts or so-called contracts. But one of the things that's increasingly found in them is in the fine print, you're basically forced to sign away your rights to ever go to court if you're wronged. This is also coming up in employment contracts. So if you're discriminated against at work, you want to go to court and redress your rights. You're not able to do it because you are forced into a private system that is really rigged for corporations. It's paid for by them. They get to choose the person who decides. And the Supreme Court, in two different cases in the past few years, has upheld these forced arbitration clauses, even if it means that you are not going to be able to get any relief when you've been discriminated against, when there's been a violation of really important federal laws.
So, I mean, explain to the person who says, well, then you don't have to sign these contracts. I mean, you're making the decision to sign the contract, so you're signing away this right to have access to redress in the courts. There seems to me to be two arguments against that. One is, you know, how impossible it is to avoid these contracts and live a life in modern day. And then also there's another argument that there is, in fact, there is a concept in the law that even if you sign a contract, the terms can be so unconscionable, I guess, in some way, that the contract is not binding. Discuss both those, though.
Yeah, and both of those are exactly right. And you're right. There's no way, if you want to have a cell phone, if you want to have a credit card, if you want to go online and, you know, use Microsoft, use Instagram, you can't do that unless you agree to these. And when arbitration first came around, it was thought of as something that would happen between sophisticated, equal bargaining partners. So between two corporations, when you are going online, you don't have any ability to negotiate, to say, no, I'm not going to sign this, and they say, fine, then you don't get to live in the modern world. You go into a job and say, you know, you're in, whether it's a low-wage job, but also higher-wage jobs where you are forced to sign this, you don't get to negotiate that part of the contract. They say, if you don't want to sign that, you don't get the job. And so many employers are having them that it's not like you can say, well, I can go get a job somewhere else.
Right.
And obviously, in this economy, it's very difficult. You're right. You know, you look at it's contract law, and it's also our Constitution. So the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution guarantees the right to trial by jury. And this is a way of circumventing the Constitution. And it's also, there is this idea that you can't be held to a contract that's unconscionable, that just shocks the conscience because it's so wrong. But that is what's happening. The Supreme Court has said, no, it doesn't matter. Before these Supreme Court decisions, lots of state courts were striking down
these arbitration clauses.
Right. And state courts were saying, you know what? This is wrong. We've had, over the course of decades, centuries, we've built up protections in our law for consumers, for workers, and we've built up these ideas that come, you know, that are as old as our country itself, that that contracts need to be fair. And so courts were striking these down, and then the Supreme Court said, nope, it doesn't matter that it's not fair. Arbitration is suddenly this, like, hallowed right that corporations have, and they can do anything with it.
Talk about the birth of arbitration. I mean, you mentioned that it was contemplated as something that two businesses would engage in, and this was a way for them to avoid costly litigation. And they could come together as there was a certain amount of symmetric power, I guess, between these two. I mean, just talk about the development of that. And really, at what point did corporate America essentially realize, like, hey, wait a second. We don't have to have this just as a business-to-business thing. We can actually have this as something where we can have the upper hand in a lot of scenarios, and this will effectively rob the consumer, the employee, of their ability to deal with this in a way that we can't control.
Yeah, so I mean, arbitration goes back to in 1925, you have the Federal Arbitration Act, which is a law passed by Congress, and you look back and you read what was said about that law at the time, and it was exactly what you said. It was about sophisticated parties, two corporations, entering into an agreement with each other, both represented by lawyers, negotiating that contract and saying, okay, here are the terms that we're going to agree to should we ever come into a dispute later on. There's nothing wrong with that. But what it's evolved into, and this has happened, this is to be looked at in this broader context of a concerted effort by corporations, by the Chamber of Commerce, over the course of the past four decades, really, of trying to insulate corporations, insulate corporate America from responsibility for wrongdoing, from accountability, from having to abide by the same laws we all have to abide by. I mean, it's no different from what we saw in the Hobby Lobby decision recently saying, you know, here's a new way for corporations to opt out of the same laws that everybody needs to participate in.
So what can be done about this? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a huge amount of latitude. If could there be could Congress pass statutes saying we will not allow arbitration to be imposed by contracts that are unilaterally drafted and unnegotiated?
Congress absolutely can do that, and Congress should do it. So this is something where the Supreme Court is completely misconstruing a law of Congress. They are misconstruing the Federal Arbitration Act to trump the Civil Rights Act, to trump our antitrust laws, to trump fair pay laws, to trump, you know, Title VII, which protects women in the workplace and protects against employment discrimination. Congress should say, Supreme Court, you've got it wrong. That's not what we meant at all. And there is a bill in Congress called the Arbitration Fairness Act. It's been introduced in the Senate by Al Franken, in the House by Hank Johnson from Georgia. It's got co-sponsors, and that's a bill that needs to move. And that bill, what the Arbitration Fairness Act would say is you cannot have pre-dispute arbitration, forced arbitration. So before you ever get into this agreement, you've already signed, or before you ever get into a disagreement, you've signed away your rights to go to court. You can't have that in the consumer context, the antitrust context, and the employment context. And that's a bill that's been out there for several years now, and it really needs to be passed. So that's what can happen in Congress. What can also happen is that federal agencies can do something about this. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was actually charged with, they were given a mandate to look into this issue, to study it, and they have the ability, if they...
How broad is their authority to deal with those things? I mean, obviously, if you fall under, if you're a bank, it seems quite obvious to me, but could they say to, AT&T?
They couldn't say it to AT&T, but they could say it to your credit card company. So they can say it to a lot of the consumer areas. So they can say it to private student lenders. They can say it to payday lenders.
Are there other agencies that might have this authority could the FCC say it about AT&T, for instance?
I think the FCC does have some authority and should be involved in this. I think, you got the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. They should be looking into this because they look at, misrepresentations that are made to consumers. They look at false advertising, and there's a lot of room for them to get involved in this. There are all kinds of federal agencies that can and should be looking at this, and so I think that there is room to make a difference on this.
If people want more information, they can go to afj.org. Is that right? The Alliance for Justice?
That's right, and we have lots of information on forced arbitration and how to fight back.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.